How's that sound? Sounds good. And microphone number two, that sounds good. We're talking to Peter Straub, author of Ghost Story, author of Floating Dragon, author of Shadowland, and a bunch more.
And others too numerous to mention.
So at any rate, when the sportscasts come on, we broadcast our sports at a quarter after, 45, I switch over to NPR. It's only an eighth of an inch away. In the evenings, of course, I don't listen to the radio, and I cannot stand to turn on television news.
No?
Especially local television news. Yeah. I've been with it all day. I've been writing it, producing it to a midday show. And
besides, there's a limit to how much of that misery you want.
It is. That's true. So usually the stereo goes on to WNCN or somebody going on this clipping.
Oh, no.
See that?
Yes.
They brought it in not because of, mostly because it mentioned that Mr. Foster was waiting for the sports report on WCBS radio.
Well, I'm glad he did something right.
How does such a friendly, mild-mannered man like yourself come up with so many horrible ways for people to die?
Gee, I bet you every friendly, mild-mannered man in America has got a lot of secrets going on in his head and lots of fantasies about offing the boss. And it's a sort of inbuilt part of the human character, I think. Imagination is what I'm really talking about.
You yourself, you have a lot of internal aggression that you would want to take out perhaps in the form of print?
I have internal aggression. Everybody does. You know, I don't think my stock is any higher than anybody else's. I have a short fuse and I get mad easy and then it's all over. But that doesn't have anything to do. My aggression, I don't think, really has much to do with the kind of scenes that I like to write. I think that comes from some other area. I don't know what it is exactly, but it's I feel so happy when I'm doing it that I can't be just releasing a lot of spoiled grape juice of myself. I mean, it's got to be something else.
When you wrote Floating Dragon, you were not angry.
No, definitely not. No, I was working too hard to experience any emotion. Mainly what I was feeling was what the characters were feeling in the course of the book. And then I had always in the back of my mind that this book had to build up to some absolutely unbelievable, fantastic, apocalyptic conclusion. And I had to sort of sweat it out until I could figure out what it was. So there was that going on in my mind, certainly.
As you wrote, then you weren't sure how you were going to finish it.
No. In fact, I very rarely am. I only wrote one novel, my first sort of ghost story called Julia, which I knew pretty much what was going to happen all during the book. The rest of the time, I just plunge in and see what's natural or see what I can come up with, what kind of inspirations I can have along the way. And Floating Dragon, by the time I got to the second third of the book, which was after about 300 typed pages, I knew that I had to have an outline because I couldn't spend the next 4 years writing this book, which looked like it was going to be endless. So I did an outline for the second third, and I wrote that, and then blasted the outline to smithereens because I put in tons of stuff that wasn't in the outline. And then I outlined the third part and invented the ending, in a really feeling very high about it. And then set in the writers, and it was as though I hadn't foreseen it when I was writing. It felt very fresh to me, and also felt by that time I was caring so much. When novelists have to remember everything in the novel, you know, you have to remember almost word for word how you put things early in the book. So otherwise, you can go astray. You know, you can have a blue-eyed guy here on one page, and he's brown-eyed on another page. But also, it's much more important for the book's internal rhythms that you have all those in your mind. So by the time I got to the end, I was carrying this immense structure on top of my head, and I felt like I was walking up a mountain, you know, carrying a big basket, and it was effort. It was also wild fun, because it gets very, very wild there toward the end.
It does indeed. But I think Floating Dragon is a very serious book. At the same time, it is not an easy book necessarily to read. It's not the kind of book that everybody is going to find a beach book.
No. It has elements of that in it, but it is. I've never been able to write a real straightforward beach book. I always I was thinking today that to get into one of my novels, you almost have to walk all the way around the outside of the novel first and circumscribe this huge territory, and then you find the way in. But there's a lot of stuff at the start of almost every book I've written. It's like a circus act, and you see, you know, a whole bunch of balls go up in the air, and you have to figure out what kind of novel this is. Where is all this material going?
I'm sorry. Did you want to tell a story in a very dramatic and almost and indeed violent way, or did you want to make a point?
Oh, the former, certainly. I wanted to write a novel which would be absolutely involving for the reader. That would really scare him at certain points, give him great, big, healthy scares. And I also wanted to affect him emotionally. I wanted this reader to feel a little bit beat up by the end of the book, but also to feel as though he loved everybody in the book and had been ravished in a way. I wanted real power, and I think I almost got it. But I never am conscious of trying to make a point. If I had a point to make, I'd write an essay, you know, or I'd write a letter to the New York Times. Writing a novel is too hard a way to sell a point, you know. Also, it's the point would be so disguised. I'm sure there is a point to it, but I don't know what it is.
The old saw applies to you. If you want to send a message, go to Western
Union. Go to Western Union, right, sure. Yeah. No, I don't have political messages at all, or any sort of message.
As I read Floating Dragon, I could almost see it as a movie, which could be very difficult to make in many respects because of the special effects involved.
Yeah.
But I almost saw it. It moved like that.
Really?
It did, because you would build up to periods of horror that... Mm-hmm. That you could almost see in the way a well-made motion picture might do.
That's supposed to happen. You know, you're supposed to be able to see those things. And if you can't see them, then I failed somehow. The writing isn't doing its job.
Of course, I might say parenthetically that the book will always be better than the movie.
Thank you. That's certainly been my experience.
Well, I was going to ask you about Ghost Story,
yeah.
Which actually I thought was a pretty good movie. Did you have a role in its making at all?
I was actively discouraged from any involvement at all by the studio. They were very polite to me, but I was always sort of kept at arm's length. They didn't even show me the script, and they kept saying, Peter, just hang on, we'll send you a script as soon as it's in real shape. But the first I knew what the movie was about was when I went to see it. They didn't want me, and I can understand that, since novelists in general are a real obsessive, gloomy bunch who would hang around making trouble. And objecting to every, you know, betrayal of their vision.
Keep the playwright off the stage.
Exactly. So anyhow, I don't think I'd be like that. And I think I could have helped them because they made mistakes, which I probably could have told them about. But
what didn't you like about it?
In general, I didn't like the movie. I thought it was badly directed, and I thought it was incoherent. That is, there are things at the end of that movie that don't make any sense at all. I think where they really fell down was they took out the little mainspring that I put in the book and substituted another mainspring. Ghost Story, the book Ghost Story, is not a ghost story. It's something else. But they made it a ghost story, a simple story of revenge about this poor girl who gets knocked off and comes back and kills the people who did her in. And that's pretty tired, you know, that kind of idea. And it's no better than what I had, which was something far stranger, but more powerful. So I kind of resented that. On the other hand, I thought Fred Astaire was just ducky. I thought he was wonderful. You know, every time you look at him, you practically smile. I mean, you want to smile. And I thought Alice Krieger was wonderful. I'd never heard of her before because I was too lowbrow to go see Chariots of Fire. But she was an astonishing actress who was just right. And Craig Wasson, a young actor who was in it, I thought he was very good. But the movie as a whole left me with a very sour taste and kind of a feeling that I'd been knifed.
Were any of your other books made into movies?
One of them was. Julia was made in a movie called The Haunting of Julia. And that was a real fast English movie made on a pretty small budget. Mia Farrow was in it, and she accounted for most of the budget, I think. But it was really incoherent, that movie. They took out the guy who did the script, did it underwater holding his breath, I think. And he left out everything that explained the action, so that there are always people you don't know how they're connected. You don't know one of them is another one's brother. You don't know that the husband fathered a child 20 years back who was really evil. You're just given the surface phenomena without any of the explanations for it. And so the movie left people very puzzled. And the director claimed that all this was intentional, that they wanted a real air of mystery about it. So, so they just left out all the explanations.
It would be very interesting to see if Floating Dragon ever can be translated.
That would be interesting, all right. I'd like to see that. I'd like to see it done by some director who isn't exactly a horror director, but has a feeling for it. And those are the hardest directors to find. I have a new film agent. We're doing our best, but... I think it
could be done, you know. They did Sophie's Choice, and I didn't think that could be ever translated. But
I haven't seen that.
It's very close to the book, I gather.
So.
Well, it's much briefer, although the movie runs, I guess, maybe almost 3 hours. It's still, and it leaves out vast portions of the book. It does have a narrative style, and but they did do a nice job with it, surprisingly enough. And
that is surprising.
Well, let me go. I want to ask you a couple other things. I know you've been asked this a million times, but I have to ask you anyway. This stunning accident at your fictional Hampstead Toll Plaza on the New Jersey Turnpike. Like, 8 people were killed. The day after that happened, I was reading Floating Dragon, and and I said, it's the same accident. You were only off by one casualty.
And one casualty, that's right.
Why do you think this was? Do you have any explanation?
I'm sure I caused it. I personally am responsible for the deaths of 7 or 8 people, and I hope the lawyers will get in touch with me as soon as possible so that we can resolve this matter. I think things like this happen all the time. Any time a novel is published, 10 things that happen in this novel happen in the world. And there was you have before you an article from a newspaper called Fair Press that in effect says, isn't this amazing? It's the only time this has ever happened. But it does happen all the time. And... any novelist, you know, has seen stuff like that a million times over. He writes something, and 2 days later it happens, or 2 weeks later it happens. It's unfortunate that there was this catastrophic accident. It would be a lot more unfortunate if other things in Floating Dragon were to come true.
Oh, please. have any these kinds of coincidences happened to you before?
I surely have, but they're so common that I don't, you know, it's usually on a more elementary level than this, you know, where you write about a character whose brother suddenly shows up out of the blue after 10 years, and sooner or later your brother or your best friend's brother shows up out of the blue. It's usually that kind of thing.
What has caused your fascination with the supernatural?
I got fascinated with it after I started to write it. As a kid, I'd been interested in ghost stories and spooky stories and Lovecraft and things like that. But then that interest sort of went away, like my interest in science fiction, which I had just previous to my interest in horror, or just after it. And then I wrote one ghost story novel, and I wrote it really to save my skin, because I was very poor. I think I'd made about $700 a year before, and made $500 a year before that. My wife Susan was supporting us and getting a little irritated that she was earning all the money and I was sitting at home. You know, I might have been watching television all day. So I wrote the novel called Julia, and I suddenly earned enough money so that we could buy a house and we could keep on living for another couple of years, and so that was solved. And I realized that my publishers would come around and stamp on me if I wrote a love story, or if I wrote anything but another sort of supernatural book. And I was sort of intrigued by what you could do in those books. So after that, I did write another book, with which I was much happier than with Julia. And it seemed to me that I discovered this wonderful little territory that almost nobody knew about, and that nobody cared for, really. And if I learned enough about it, I could make that territory mine, you know, and I could take it places where nobody ever thought it could go, I thought. So I just got into it deeper and deeper. And I made discoveries and I made inventions, and I think I did find new things to do with.
Do you indeed believe in the supernatural, or do you reserve it strictly for your novels?
It's strictly for books, really. In the middle of the night, anybody can believe in the supernatural. You know, if you hear a funny noise out there in the hall, who knows what that is? You know, so there's a little atavistic... caveman part of the brain that says ghost, a monster.
No, I'm not so sure. I live on the west side of Manhattan.
You got plenty of monsters around you.
Where did you grow up and go to school?
I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I went to a boys' school there, which was very similar to the boys' school in Shadowland, though not as sinister as that school. And then I went to the University of Wisconsin and was an English major, and got it. And then I went to Columbia and was a graduate student and got a master's degree. And then Susie and I got married, and I was a teacher for a bit at that same school. It's the only job I've ever had, apart from summer jobs. And then we wanted to get out of Milwaukee, and so I became a graduate student in Ireland. And it was in Ireland that I really started to write. And I think part of the point of going to Ireland was so that I could be, there could be a curtain between me and my parents and my wife's parents and anybody who might say, "You're an idiot. You can't make a living doing that."
So aside from the teaching job, the writing has been a full-time profession?
Yeah, it's a full-time job for me. And it's much better that way. I don't know how people can teach 8 hours or work in a factory 8 hours and go home and write, because writing is exhausting stuff. It it takes little pieces of you out of you, and it's it's exhausting.
People force themselves to do it.
It's
especially true of news people who like to write, and
sure.
They sit at a typewriter all day. And much as I love to write, but going home and looking at another typewriter is not what I want to do.
Oh, that would be murder. I could never do that in a million years. Once I was being interviewed in Texas by a newsman who was a writer, and he said that his daughter gave him a little plaque. This is real revealing, I think. And the plaque said, he said, my heart went out because it was just right. And the plaque said, "I hate to write, but I love to have written." And I said, "I feel exactly the other way around. I don't give a damn about having written. I love writing. You know, that's I enjoy the activity. I'm happiest in the middle of a book, not at the end of a book. End of a book, I'm always so confused about where I am or what's going on that I'm a little spacey. But the feeling of having written isn't anything. That's, it's something dead."
My colleague H. Paul Jeffers, who is the assistant news director here, has written about a dozen novels himself, and including one that was published last year called Shootout at the Onyx, which is, he writes mysteries. He has written Sherlock Holmes and Hardboiled mysteries. But he considers his job at CBS part-time, his real job is writing.
That's right. So it's the hobby that supports him, though.
You're using some of the new writing techniques, aren't you?
Am
such
I?
As the word processors.
Oh, yes.
How do you make use of that?
Well,
What do you have, first of all?
I have an IBM display writer, which I adore. I mean, if it were a woman, Susie'd be through. I'd be married to it. Because it gives me exactly what I need, that machine. It's makes it easy to write. And as you know yourself, I'm sure, as all news people know, you can do anything on the screen, and it replaces about half an hour of using whiteout or backing up on your IBM typewriter and retyping. All you got to do is push backspace on my machine and zingo. As far back as you backspace, everything's gone. So you can just retype. It's fantastically easy to make corrections, and it's fantastically easy to revise. And then when you're done, you have an absolutely beautiful manuscript that, of course, could never be typed by human hands because every letter is uniformly imprinted, and everything is in a perfect straight line, and you can even justify the right-hand margin. You get a really sexy-looking manuscript.
I'm trying to imagine it. It's hard for me to do. Does it come out in paper, letter size?
There are two kinds. Mine comes out on normal paper. You just feed in the machine. There's the other kind that has computer paper, which is that kind that is like one long accordion sheet, and it comes through, and it's got whole perforations down the side, which you can peel off. That struck me as unaesthetic. I wanted to use real paper and not that darn computer stuff.
Does the computer assemble the pages?
It'll collate the pages.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. But that's because if you want to print out five copies of the same multi-page document, first it'll print out document one, then it'll print out the second copy of it, and then the third. So it's everything is in order.
Well, when you reach the bottom of the page, does it know when to stop
sure.
and go on to a second page?
Yep.
So there's no stopping, no reloading, or anything like
that? No, as long as you have a page feeder. What you do is make sure the page feeder is filled, and then the machine makes all those wonderful little burps and clicks, and the thing goes whooshing down into a huge slot, and then it prints like crazy. I mean, it must print a lot of characters per second, and it prints backwards and forwards, so there's no wasted motion. And then the sheet cranks itself up, and you hear all the burps and wheezes again, and another sheet of paper slides into the slot to be typed on.
Richard Condon in the year after he got back from Ireland. He wrote in Ireland.
Oh, he was in Ireland a long time.
Were you there? We were there at the same time,
but we had different social circles.
Well, he also uses a word processor and just loves it. And he knocks out novels very fast. He likes to knock out a novel within about a couple of months.
I'd like to, too. I mean, I wish you'd tell me how you do it.
Well, your approach is much more serious than Richard Condon's, although he has a way with words, and he's very clever.
Yeah.
But you have a much more sober approach in your writing than Richard Condon.
That doesn't necessarily mean it's more serious. In Richard Condon, there's a sense that there's this real paranoia that corresponds to reality. But it's just slightly twisted up from reality, you know. Who's to say that the mafia doesn't really run the White House, you know?
Yeah, there
are all these
feeling.
Crazy paranoid schemes.
Yeah, there's a feeling of insanity that runs through Condon.
But it's a insanity that seems very close to the truth.
I'm going to wrap it up. I have just one other. Oh, I wanted to ask, what kind of discipline do you have for yourself as a full-time writer with the word processor? Do you force yourself to work between 9 and 5, or how does it work?
I never start to work that early, but I pretty generally, on normal days, I start about between 10 and 11, and I work until about 6 o'clock at night. And everybody says, you know, at parties, when people say, what do? I say, I'm a writer. And I say, oh, you must be very disciplined. The truth is, if I didn't write, I'd have to sit around home and watch the soap operas all day long. Or I'd have to take out the garbage or, you know, do the shopping. I do some of that. But life would be very, very boring without occupation. So it's not discipline so much. It's just that I have to do it or I'm going to go nuts.
Peter Straub, my last question is, your neighbors in Westport, Connecticut, are they picking out glimpses of themselves in the Floating Dragon?
I think they're absolutely delighted. And they're reading themselves in the characters. They have no connection with them because they desperately want to see themselves.
And, of course, they recognize all the places
landmarks
in their community.
Sure.
And what's next for you?
I'm writing a book with Stephen King called The Talisman. We're doing this on our word processors. And we're at about page 800, or since Stephen has this section now and he's a very prolific writer, maybe we're at page 900 now. And it's going very well. It's going fantastically well. And both Steve and I are sort of in awe of this book because it just picked itself up. It stood up like a huge mountain, you know, suddenly struggled to its feet and started to move. And it seems to me now to be an absolutely dazzling book, just full of little miracles and full of tenderness, too.
Maybe we'll have you back, maybe for
maybe we'll
a progress
back.
Report.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.